Welcome to University Drive, your pathway to the transformational work of University of the Bahamas. Our goal is to build a better Bahamas by shaping tomorrow's leaders today, finding solutions to challenges, and forging new opportunities for growth. University Drive, where faculty, staff, students, and alumni travel the road of progress together with you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to University Drive. We are so excited to have you connect with us for season 8 of the show. Over the years, we have been showcasing the greatness that resides in our university and how, with diverse partners, the academic community has been steadily continuing down that road of progress. Our guest today is Assistant Professor of Design and the Head of Visual Arts and the Design Department at UB, Ms. Keisha Oliver. I'm your host, Tamika Lundy. Ms. Oliver, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Great. Not only are you a member of faculty, but you're also an alumna of University of the Bahamas. I also always try to state whenever we have guests who are also alumni.
Yes. So I attended the University of the Bahamas, then College of the Bahamas, when I was only 16. In fact, I had finished my studies in the UK. And I joined the associates of the marketing program. I was pursuing my associates in marketing at the college, and I completed that. And I started that in 1999, I think it was. Yeah. And it was interesting being in that space with people who were a little older than me. And so it's been such a joy to come back, not only as a faculty, but I started off in UB working alongside the team in university relations as a graphic designer. So I have enjoyed my journey at the university, and I'm really excited about not only giving back to the university, but giving back to the Bahamas.
That's so wonderful to hear. You've come full circle. You were a student and went abroad and did everything that you needed in order to deepen your footprint. And then now you're back as a faculty member and you're doing some pretty amazing things. Recently, you earned a new designation, that of the Fall 2021 Fellow of the Clark Art Institute in Massachusetts. In fact, you are joining us virtually from the US right now. It must be so exciting to not only have received this fellowship, but to be in the middle of that journey. You are the first recipient as such under the Caribbean Art and its Diasporas Fellowship. Tell us some more about that, because I know that's a whole mouthful, but from what I understand, it's really a focus on art historians and artists, critics, and writers working in the realm of critical Caribbean scholarship, art, and visual practices. What does that all mean?
Yeah, it is a lot. And even for me, it was a lot when I applied for the fellowship last year, because again, I'm operating in the space of being a designer and sometimes a curator when there's time. And this particular fellowship focuses on art history. So I'm applying for something that's really out of the purview of my discipline and my area of specialty. But I think the nuances of the pandemic in 2020 allowed a lot of us to become a lot bolder and starting to take hold of our destiny and futures and be a little bit more confident. And so I took that mantle of confidence and I applied to the Clark Art Institute, which is essentially a public art museum and a leading international center for research that for many years has supported a distinguished research and academic program that kind of houses these fellowships in cycle with the fall and spring semesters of universities. And so being here in Massachusetts, it has been interesting. I've been here since September and I have a few more weeks here. And I've been kind of focusing on unearthing archival material within marginalized and underdocumented histories, particularly in Bahamian art in the 1950s and 1960s. And I think why the Clark Art Institute really selected me as a recipient for the fellowship is because of the sense of urgency of this work. We're dealing with a kind of generation of artists, arts educators, institutions that are part of a dying generation. You know, this is, you know, going on 70 years almost. And so very critical. And I'm thinking this is why they wanted to support this work.
So I'm very curious, how does one make the transition from being an artist or a creator or a member of the creative community to making the transition to being intrinsically involved in art history? How did that happen for you?
I fell into it. And like I said, even still, I'm grappling with it because I identify now as of 2 days ago, you know, giving my first public lecture as an emerging art historian. I'm just grappling with that title because I feel that there are so many others who have put in so much work as not only historians, when we look at, you know, professors at the university, like Dr. Christopher Curry and the work that Dr. Nicolet Bethel does in archaeology. I feel that we have a lot of people who have contributed so much, right? And so that those titles, they come with a extensive length of scholarship. And here I am, just emerging. And so I use that, I wear that title, that, and I take that mantle with care and with a sense of responsibility that I think more of us need to embrace. But looking outside of the university, we do have arts critics like Patricia McCollis. We have researchers and arts enthusiasts like Pamela Burnside. And we have people like art historian Erica James, Krista Thompson, who have paved the way for persons like myself who are just coming into the fold. And I'm excited about this moment because I feel that although I'm bringing a different set of skills as a designer, as an educator, as a curator, I too have a role, a responsibility as a citizen historian or as a citizen archivist, because I think we as a people have a culture of preserving within our own personal archives, our personal oral histories, but it's to bring that to the fore of national archives is what I'm interested in.
I totally understand. And this is a purely subjective statement on my part. So I'm going to give that disclaimer right now. But I've always felt like art in the Bahamian society has almost been relegated to like a second class state in our society. I'm not sure if we as citizens have really grown to appreciate the impact and how art has not only helped to transform us, but really been a critical conduit for change. Am I right? Am I wrong? What is your take on that?
Yeah, I do believe that, you know, when we look at the word, the definition, the root of the arts, and it being at the very root, this kind of form of creative expression, I think we have to realize that art doesn't just mean a painting on a wall, you know, it is the music, it is the writing, it is the performance, the dancing, the junkanoo, it is all of that. And when you look at it as a whole, as a collective, they all impact almost every aspect of our society. In a way that the artists are expressing who we are in politics, who we are in business, who we are in education. And so we need to appreciate it for what it is a little bit more, I think, and also appreciate the histories, particularly those that have been underdocumented, that have brought us to this point. Because those that established arts education in the 50s, it's only because of them that I am here right now as an arts educator. And so it is those things that I'm really interested in as it relates to this work.
Connecting your past to the present. You are right now in Massachusetts during this pandemic, pursuing your fellowship. What is that experience like so far?
So navigating the pandemic, it hasn't been much of a challenge since being here, to be honest, because I'm within the Williamstown, Massachusetts area, so very kind of conservative with their pandemic restriction policies, and they're good with testing, with access to spaces. I think as of November 1st, they have their new policy mandate would be that only fully vaccinated persons are allowed within different spaces like the Williams College facility that is affiliated with the Clark Art Institute, the Institute itself, a few museums in the area. And so I feel safe in that regard. And I'm happy that they've implemented these policies because it allows you to be a little bit more focused on what you're here to do, the research, right? But outside of managing, you know, the loss of people affected, you know, family and friends, that has really, there's really been no challenge. But interestingly, you talk about experiences. I think for me, the reality of being a Black woman in America, particularly a Caribbean woman of color, it in a town with a population of like, I don't know, let's say 2 to 3% of people that look like me, and even less people from the region, right? I think it's been so interesting navigating that space because of all the rhetoric around this kind of moment in racial inequalities, and even being within an academic space that, again, there are not a lot of scholars that look like me or that are coming from the same space of a small island kind of developing state, a space where history has not been recorded in many ways. And the history within world context for us within art, Bahamian art, Caribbean art is fairly new. So I think sometimes that has been more of an interesting kind of experience that has from in many ways not made the pandemic a non-issue because of the safety measures here. I feel very safe.
So you mentioned something earlier in relation to the work that you're doing, which is focusing on marginalized art histories. What do you mean by that?
So when we look at marginality, when we look at underdocumented kind of histories, I'm thinking specifically when it comes to Bahamian art that the focus is on those people that we've heard their names, but that's all we know. We have seen a painting by them, but we don't know their background. So those persons that we know of, or those that we may not know of at all, and there is no scholarship, there's no archival record of their existence. And I kind of, you know, coming into this space, I feel that cultural conservation in the Bahamas is almost like a vanishing necessity. Its momentum for me has been lost to like this generation of post-independence historians, like the documentarians and the academics, who in many ways realize the importance of our country's sovereignty and path towards decolonialism. But then, you know, no support for funding, scholarship trends shift, and then we lose that momentum, right? And so my research interest is really focusing on unearthing these kind of marginalized histories, because it's important for us to know where we're going as a people, both individually and collectively, in context to our past, right? If we don't know where we've come from, it really impacts how we identify, who we identify as, and how we make connections with the way our society is evolving, right? And I know when it comes to art, people think, oh, I don't know, art, you know, it's not economy, it's not commerce, you know, it's just art. Yeah, right? And I think it's so much bigger than that, right? And for me, the work is really about examining how this intersection of design and decolonial theory, because we want to decolonize everything, but what are we doing to make active progress towards that? We talk about it so much, but what are we doing? And I want to be able to kind of yield a more inclusive record of art history, one that isn't biased, one that doesn't just celebrate these dominant figures that over and over again, we hear the same names and we think that they are the only representations of Bahamian art. And there are so many others that we just don't know about because either the media houses or the memory institutions are suppressing them because they have no more information, or they are not bothering to find this information to celebrate these people who too have a place in our history.
So you are being intentional about what we've always been, well, what we've been saying recently or lately over the years, which is we have to tell our story. We have to tell our story. So yeah. You are helping to add to that tapestry of story and archival kind of development that we need so that we can know our story so that we can tell it, right?
Exactly. Like, you know how frustrating it is to hear someone who knows nothing about where your people have come from, kind of adding their gaze, be it colonial or otherwise, speaking things that may have just no real bearing on the foundations of the truth. Because for me, when we look at history, history isn't just what happened in the past. History, if you think about it, is a selection or a series of curated moments, curated by those who are the authority figures in media, in universities, in memory institutions. And so if we have people who have the right to either create, uplift, elevate certain institutions or certain people within history and then silence others, that right there is mind-blowing, because it means that some of the most important figures in our history never get their flowers, never are become affiliated with the very fabric of the establishment of art education, for example, because they're being dwarfed by these dominant histories that have been curated by a very colonial driven archive.
So the lens becomes just as important as the history that's being told or the narrative that's being produced.
Exactly, exactly. And we don't want bias. I think when you bring bias within history, then, and we've seen it over and over again, we come from our history, when we look back all the way from the Tainos, we come from a history of erasure culture, where I think the very fabric of us not knowing a lot about our material culture from the Taino people or our African kind of heritage that was just kind of wiped away, right, by colonialism, this settler mentality. And I think there's a certain trauma that even in today's society with individual behemoths, that it's almost like we don't really care about what happened then. You know, I'm not saying this for everybody, but it's like what is happening now is so much more important than what happened 20, 30, 40 years ago. But if you really look at what happened in the past and you kind of relate it to what is happening now, you can imagine I'm sitting in the library and I'm looking through microfilm from the newspapers in the 1940s. And because I prefaced my research into this period to look at what happened before, right, what led up to the 1950s. And you're seeing they're dealing with hurricanes back then. They're also dealing with the challenges of migration of people from Haiti back then. We're dealing with these same problems. How can we learn from what was happening then to make changes within society now, so we're not still dealing with these same problems 50 years from now, or we're dealing with them in a way that it has a little bit more of a proactive mentality and not reactive. So history has the ability to propel. And I think a lot of people feel that our histories that are controversial are only there to oppress. But I feel that if you embrace it in a way that is optimistic, it can propel who we become as a people.
So this sounds like really deep and substantive research work that you are undertaking. Where did you get your inspiration from for this kind of work?
Well, I've taught UB's Arts 107 course. It's entitled The Introduction to Bahamian and Caribbean Art. I've taught it for 7 years. And there's always been this gap, this specific gap within the history of early Bahamian art education that even I knew very little about. Since the publishing of Bahamian Art, this text in 1992 by Patricia McCullis alongside Charles Huggins and Basil Smith, the only real scholarship that has emerged are a few exhibition catalogs produced by the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas and some essays produced by Dr. Erica James. But even within those texts, these pioneers of 1950s, like Horace Wright, who was the only, when I say the only, he was the only art teacher for almost a decade from just 1951 to just about 1960, 61, only art teacher in the Bahamas. And you know, we're an archipelago. So he is, when I say important, he is an integral part of how arts education was molded and framed, right? He paved the way for all of us in the arts. So we should be celebrating him like a national hero. We should have books about him. But again, he appears as a footnote in our history. Don Russell, he was another prominent figure. He established an academy when he returned to the Bahamas in the early 50s after being trained at the Art Students League in New York. But with him, I don't even have a photograph to tell you how he looks. And I have been aggressive in trying to locate any information. And all I know is that his family is from Managua. His parents moved to New York in the early 1900s. He came back in 53. And he's related to the Ford family. Vera Ford Cartwright specifically was his first cousin. I know this information, but it's going to take a lot of field work, a lot of calling someone sister, cousin, mother, brother, you know, that kind of way to get that work done. And then finally, there's David Ronsley, but he was British. So he came from the UK in the early, he came from the UK in the late 50s, rather, 1957, specifically to establish the Chelsea Pottery that was funded by Sir Harold Christie and Sir Francis Peake as a way to get what they said in the 1957 article, Islanders acquainted with a new craft. And so it became this kind of apprenticeship space. And these three figures are integral to how arts education started in the 50s, but there is very little that is shared. It's almost as if everyone feels art started, or creativity or culture started, with the establishment of independence. Yeah, that's when we started recording, but our history goes way past that.
This is all so fascinating to me. And we're going to talk a little bit more about those figures that you mentioned. We are having a conversation about the underrepresented art historical period of the 1950s and the 1960s with UB Assistant Professor Keisha Oliver, who's the first recipient of the Clark Art Institute's Caribbean Art and its Diasporas Fellowship. We'll take this break and be back after this.
Chapter One Bookstore is your back-to-school headquarters. We are proud to serve the students, faculty, and staff of the University of the Bahamas and the community at large. We are the premier choice for the purchase of university textbooks and supplies and UB logo apparel, paraphernalia, and gifts. We also carry a wide variety of school supplies, learning aids, and leisure books. Visit our copy center throughout the semester for all of your printing, copying, and binding needs. Chapter One Bookstore is located on the ground floor of the Michael Eldon Complex. Shop with us on Monday through Friday between the hours of 8:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. Call us at 397-2650 or email us at chapter1@ub.edu.bs. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Chapter One Bookstore. See you soon!
Welcome back to University Drive. I'm your host, Tamika Lundy, and our conversation today is with Assistant Professor Keisha Oliver, Head of Visual Arts and Design Department at University of the Bahamas. We've been talking about the catalysts for the work that Keisha Oliver has been doing at the Clark Art Institute in Massachusetts. And you're focusing on the art history period of the 1950s and the 1960s. How did you get to focus on that particular period?
So for me, I've always been this individual that has been intrigued by the unknown, right? Like asking the questions, you know, that the child that always says, but why? But why? And so for me, this gap, it always bothered me that the very thing, the very beginning of the artistic development in our country, marked by the 1950s establishment of arts education through these figures, Horace Wright, Donald Russell, David Ronsley, through the Chelsea Pottery, that there was only a very little information. And when we think in the kind of space of memory work and archiving, you know, it's not that long ago. Yes, it is over 70 years, but in archival space, it's not like 1,000 years ago, right? So we should be able to find something. And for me to be teaching the Intro to Caribbean and Bahamian Art course and not have sufficient information on the foundations of art education, the men and the creatives who then trained the first generation of Bahamian modernists, it bothered me. And it made me, it fueled this passion to find out more and be able to be that person to advocate for that level of scholarship, that level of focus on this moment, these figures and their histories.
What are we at risk of, or what are we in danger of when we do not investigate and devote attention to a subject matter like what you are researching now? What are we at risk of losing in our Bahamianness and our own self-awareness?
So there are a few things at play. And I think one thing that stands out as paramount to these kind of skewed or misrepresented histories is the fact that we have the continuum of dominant histories that, like I said before, aren't necessarily the entire framework, right? And how are we going to grow as a people? How are we going to evolve if the dominant histories only represent a single voice of bias? So inclusivity has a lot of work to do. And when we think about empowering people, because the more Bahamians that can see themselves in the history, the more we empower the next generation of creatives, educators, scientists, business owners, politicians. And for me, when we look at the arts, we look at someone like a Brent Malone. As beloved as he is, he was not the only artist that kind of emerged in the 60s. His contemporary was let's call them an outsider artist. Outsider artists are typically those that are kind of embraced as untrained or self-taught. And so we have a Homer Milton Williams, who came up in the same kind of time and moment as a Brent Malone. But Brent Malone always existed as that dominant figure in that time, that period. But while Homer Williams, just as talented, just as successful, he was able to elevate himself to being not only a cultural advocate, he was one of the first artists to have a space at the Jumbe Village Center. I don't know if you remember, in Blue Road, that was kind of erased from our culture again.
The center.
I know. And so this Homer Milton Williams, he in fact has been the focus of my research as the first archival profile, because again, we're dealing with a period of artists that are a dying generation, right? So Homer Milton Williams was born in 1940 in Miguana, and he unfortunately had a journey that didn't reflect those of his contemporaries. He was imprisoned at a young age. He was let out early, I guess, on good behavior. The dynamics and the intricacies of his story I have yet to unfold, because I have to follow up with interviews when I return to the Bahamas. But his underdog narrative is so inspiring. Let me tell you, I hunted this man down before I left home. I found him the week before I left Nassau to come to Massachusetts, because everybody in the art community thought that they didn't think he was alive, or if he was alive, that he had no memory and recollection of his heyday in the arts. But I found him. I started to document what I could, you know, because you have to massage your relationship when you meet someone that has been essentially erased from history, right? And it was just a breath of fresh air, you know, no air about him. He was so excited to be in the presence of someone who wanted to know about his past, who wanted to know about his journey. And so we have him as a figure, but a marginalized figure. And it's so interesting too, because he was marginalized, his work was marginalized or thought to be lesser than. And the moment that I've uncovered him, there's all this attention now because you see his works have become more valuable because they have existed. They have endured 50, 70 years. And so now we have those that are looking with opportunism in their eyes and thinking, oh, now we should celebrate him. And so I think it's very important for us to think about inclusivity when we're looking at our history and archive, because we don't know at what point the future is going to think that that person is worthy of inclusion. So let's just include them all from the jump start.
So while we're on the subject of Homer Williams, what kind of work has he done?
And this is the really interesting thing. Like initially he was considered, because thinking about it now, he was imprisoned, in the 60s, let out an early release in 67, 68, thereabout. And he worked with Elise Wasile and her husband, William Wasile, in the Nassau Art Gallery as a resident artist. And so he was producing art for tourists. So that genre of art called tourist art, we're all familiar, the beautiful seascapes and landscapes that we ourselves as Bahamians, or a certain generation of Bahamians, found an affinity in. Yeah, if someone can create a beautiful rendition of the Montague kind of facade, that is considered high art, that is considered beautiful art. And so he was creating a lot of his works when he first was released from prison. And then he seemed to start to find his own kind of voice, his own tonality and style once he left that kind of that moment of incarceration and feeling obligated to those who helped him kind of leave on early release. Then he started at Jumbe Village. And it was at that point where you see him coming to his own in the 70s, now also coinciding with our independence, very interesting parallels there as well. And he's making work that are including the people, right? Which is something that's very special, including Bahamians in the landscape, because for years, for centuries, we didn't see our own, be it the Tainos, the Africans, whoever, being rendered by the European artists, American artists who are coming to the Bahamas to create works. We didn't see them for a long time, including the locals. And so Harry was embracing his own people in the work, and he evolved from there. From Jumbe Village, he was able to be invited by a contemporary, James Rule, who himself emerged under the mentorship of Horace Wright as a very influential arts educator and cultural officer who works along with Edmund Moxey at the Jumbe Village kind of establishment. And you see a community, not only of people working together, but how mentorship was so important then. And Homer Milton Williams evolved his work, was able to start to chronicle these ideas of politics. You know, we go back to saying how art is important. You have this artist who, although he started to produce tourist art, you see that he, in his later works, he's representing those historical themes that document the struggle for majority rule. And there was the grouping of paintings that he had that I found. And after our conversation, he connected me with one of his avid collectors, the late Cecil Gonzalez, whose daughter had the collection. And so I made contact with her. You can imagine a lot of WhatsApping and a lot of, you know, this person and cousin and this and that. It was a lot of that happening, but it was so worth it. And I was a, pardon?
Super sleuth.
Yes. And and when I found these, I had to, one of my students, he's worked with me as an unofficial assistant along with one or two females, but I needed a male to work along with some others because these works were so large. These are like larger than the typical plywood because these are works on wood. They're more ranging from 6 feet by 13 feet. Very huge pieces, very heavy. And so I was able to, in the latter part of August, we went to her storage facility and she had 11 original works produced in the early 70s that landscapes, seascapes, but what was most interesting, because her father had a club, I think it was called the Zonta Club on Dalzwell Street, that all sorts of people, all sorts of walks of life, you know, politicians, business owners, everyone came to that space, a real hub for community. And he had Homer Milton Williams create two portraits of Sir Lyndon Penlan and one of Roland Simonet. And, you know, if you're just looking at them, you're like, yeah, they're former prime ministers, but then make the connection with the 1967 election and how important that was for the Bahamian people, the first Black-led government, right? And how Sir Randolph Foulkes was able to help us make that, you know, make that jump to the first Black-led government in that lock hold of 18 seats on both sides. It's just all very fascinating. And here we have an artist who, again, these works were locked up for so long. No one's seen them except me giving the lecture. And when I create a digital archive space to share them with the people, this is who this work is for. So they too can learn about our history through art. And so Homer Milton Williams is very special, and his narrative, his journey is as special as dominant figures like Brent Malone, because he too is contributing to the evolution of who we are as a people. So yes, he too has a place. He deserves a place in our history.
So you mentioned two other names, I believe, who you are researching in terms of their connection and their contributions to the development of art education?
Yes. And so those would be Horace Wright, you know, coming up in the 50s, he not only was a teacher, but he also in his latter years, he served as the kind of arts education officer for the Ministry of Education. And what I find interesting with him is this ability to, and it's something that's it's a rarity now. We don't see a lot of it, this kind of passing on of a mantle. He was able to do that, you know? He was able to identify two of his students, nurture them, and allow them to take on the responsibilities of developing the arts curriculum for the country in the 70s and their generation, because he did it in the 50s, they did it in the 70s. And so those two were Hervis Bain, and we know Hervis Bain as the kind of the brain behind the national symbols for our country, the creative kind of genius there, but he was also an arts educator. And then James Rolle, who came shortly after Hervis Bain in that role of education officer for arts and craft for the country. He served in that capacity, and the Ministry of Culture also fell under Ministry of Education at the time. And he served as the kind of cultural officer working with E. Clement Bethel, actually, oftentimes to curate exhibitions that helped to give visibility to Bahamian art, not only here in the Bahamas, but he also curated some that made kind of rotations around the US, particularly Washington, DC. So we have these people, and frankly, I know it's sad, but they're men because of the dynamics of the inequalities then. But the figures were men at that time. But we do have instances where we see a Meta Davis Cumberbatch, a Gail Saunders, because although Gail Saunders has emerged as an historian, she too has interests within the arts, particularly in you know, her younger years, right? And it's just so interesting and so fascinating to see the community of people that started the arts and how they have evolved into these, for me, they're superheroes. They're Bahamian superheroes, because we call them heroes, but they had superpowers to endure all of the nuances of the oppression, the inequalities, the pervasiveness of privilege, particularly white privilege, right, during that time.
So what are the outputs for the work that you're doing?
There's so much that I intend for this work. And I think it would be pretty premature of me really to kind of have a definitive listing of what that could look like, but I'm kind of circling these ideas of, one, decolonizing the archive. So creating an archive that can speak more to these ideas of inclusivity that I talked about, but that can also think about online and digital availability, because obviously that's a huge trend now as it relates to access. Because when we look at the institutional archives, for example, within the National Archives, the University of the Bahamas, or within the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas, they have their limitations because we don't as a people have as much access to them, or we don't think we have as much access to them. But as soon as knowledge becomes accessible through online platforms, we see how the people seem to be more empowered. And that has, you know, it's a two-edged sword there, but I think access is really important. And this idea of collaborative and inclusivity as well, because again, the institutions have a certain kind of framing around how they tell a story and what that gaze is like. And so you often see these very much curated dominant histories. But if you open that up to something that's more collaborative, where you have it open source, so you invite the public to submit their contributions, and you have the personal archive leaning or lending to the national archive, that's when it becomes rich, right? So that's what it's really all about, this idea of kind of liberating the power of knowledge through decolonizing the archive in a framework that is community-based. And I've been working on, and through the graciousness of the Clark, who has been able to help me establish a platform, a repository online that is at this point called the Bahamas Arts Archives, and specifically arts with an S, because it's not just visual arts, but literary, performing, because they all kind of are a melting pot of who we are as a people, and they all influence each other. And really, that is a more of an immediate goal for me, looking at how I can create a space that people can access easily and see what is happening. And this is not new. I know that there are others that are doing similar works, like the Baja Archives, which was established, I think, just maybe last year, if I'm not mistaken. That's more about the overarching history of the Bahamas. And the team there are working with actually literally just sharing archival information that exists within the Library of Congress, within National Archives, and using the millennial act of kind of sharing in online spaces for educational purposes to secure and to help safeguard how that information is shared and why it is being shared, right? And you see the momentum, you see how people are responding to seeing, you know, how Bay Street looked like in the 40s, for example. So those are the things that I'm really focusing on, this digital archive, these projects surrounding Homer Milton Williams. And like a few people have suggested, which was already something that I've been doing with an exhibition that I curated this past semester, Masterminds, that focuses on the 90s, in oral history and the integrity of what our history is through spoken word, through interviews, and how that is integral to this type of research.
This is all very, very fascinating. We're speaking with Keisha Oliver, assistant professor at University of the Bahamas. We're talking art history and the period of the 50s and 60s and research that's underway about it. We'll take another break, but don't go anywhere. We'll be back after this.
To protect yourself and others from COVID-19, stay home as much as possible and avoid close contact with others. Wear a mask that covers your nose and mouth when you leave home. Wash your hands with soap and water for at least 20 seconds or use alcohol-based hand sanitizer. Practice social distancing. If you must leave home, stay at least 6 feet away from other people and disinfect items you must touch. Limit in-person contact as much as possible. To prevent the spread of COVID-19 if you're sick, avoid public transportation, ride sharing, or taxis. Stay home if you're sick, except to get medical care. Remember to call ahead first. Separate yourself from other people and pets in your home. Everyone is at risk of getting COVID-19. Older adults and people of any age who have serious underlying medical conditions may be at higher risk for more severe illness. This message is brought to you by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and University of the Bahamas.
Welcome back to University Drive. Keisha Oliver, you have been taking us on the journey that you're on your fellowship at the Clark Art Institute in Massachusetts, adding to the body of knowledge about individuals who have contributed to art education. You've been doing some really keen work over there in Massachusetts. What exactly have you been able to do while at the Clark Art Institute? as a fellow.
And so before I talk about what I've been able to do here, I kind of like to preface it with what I did back home, because it's they work in tandem. So before coming, I decided to phase the research so that when I was home, I focused on collecting oral histories from the living historians and artists and arts enthusiasts who had recollection of that time, of that period, because I know that that would help to inform a lot of what I wanted to do in this space and over here with these resources, right? And it has been invaluable, right? That collecting that information. And we should never discredit the worth, the value of our stories and how they impact not only what is happening in the Bahamas, but within the region, and even in the instance of the arts, the international scope. And I say that too, because coming into the space of working in the US and having the resources, not only of the different universities, museums, libraries, et cetera, within the United States, but the interlibrary loan resource has been invaluable at the Clark, because I have access to information anywhere in the world. In fact, being at the Clark, I was able to access the microfilms of the Nassau Guardian and the Tribune that have been, I think, gifted to two institutions outside of the Bahamas, and that's the Library of Congress, as well as the University of Florida. So the research here has been focusing on looking at the foreign art that was produced in the Bahamas during the 50s and 60s. And you'll be surprised, although we had about 9 artists that were Bahamian working in that time, either within the purview of the lens of being a dominant figure or marginalized, there were 9 of them. But when we look at non-Bahamian, there were like over 36, close to 40 that I have been able to discover in my short period. And think about this now, I've only been here a couple of weeks, and we're looking at maybe just shy of under 2 months. And that is what I was able to discover with archival material. It's not just knowing their names, but having references to their time there, having guidelines or having references to their work and making those connections. So using the resources to tap into some of the things that I was unable to do. So from looking at the local art production by the Horace Wright, the Don Russell, the Homer Milton Williams, the Brent Malone, the Maxwell Taylor, those figures of Bahamian art, local artists, and finding whether or not they have works that exist within the outside of the Bahamas that I can access through all of the resources here. And then looking again at those artists, like I'd mentioned, who are American or European that visited, because a lot of people don't know, you know, migration for us now is, you know, hopping on a plane to either go on a business trip or go shopping, etc. But back then, a lot of people flocked to the Bahamas from outside, so from Europe specifically, or from parts of the American West, to escape the cold, right? And so they came there to escape the cold, particularly for illness. And so you had a lot of that happening, not just to come for sunshine and sea and beaching and tanning. No, they came there for long periods oftentimes, and then they left. And it is interesting to see that migration, right? The undertones of migration on the impacts of the foreign kind of influences on our visual culture, particularly with this movement of artists and art between the Bahamas, the US, and then Europe. And for me, being here in Massachusetts, in I guess the Berkshires, New England, and the proximity to New York, it's been so fascinating to see the important connection between New York and the Bahamas, even more so than the UK, because you think of colonialism, you think British rule, but a lot of migration happened between the Bahamas and New York. Even so, if we go back to what we were talking about earlier, about like making these interesting connections and looking at how art is impacting other aspects of society, we see how when I'm looking through the microfilm, and imagine I'm looking through a decade of microfilm, right? How I'm able to see through the advertising of airline and airfares that New York pops up quite a bit, right? And so you see how the influx is affected by advertising, marketing, et cetera. And so just some interesting parallels that some things you just can't theorize, you can't even analyze, because all I'm doing here is trying to find as much information while I have access to these amazing resources. I mean, state of the art, you know, I am here and able to look through a year of microfilm. And at the time of looking through the microfilm, I myself have authorship in downloading the PDF and saving that to my own repository so that I can use it later on. And I'm able to do a year in 8 hours. Whereas when I was back home in Nassau and looking at the National Archives, and just with the limitation of the pandemic and access in that regard, it takes me almost a week to go through a year of the microfilm.
Wow, technology and digitalization.
I know, right?
So the future and the present.
Yeah, so you know, and it's, you know, we know the realities back home with, you know, financing certain aspects of our kind of processes and how, you know, we are slightly disadvantaged because, you know, the Clark is a very prestigious institution that the donors and the kind of funding that it has the ability to do this, right? It has the ability to provide me and the other scholars with the resources to make the process so much easier, right? When we look at the field work, I call it the grunt work because, you know, it is grunt work. And I am here to collect as much as I can find and then take that back home once I leave to now start to synthesize, analyze, collate, create this amazing, rich archive of information that yes, it existed. I am not discovering it. It is being rediscovered, but there's something very unique about that rediscovery and collating and then sharing with our people that I think will change the narrative on how we decide to archive in the future.
Mm-hmm. So you just recently gave a public lecture, Almost Forgotten, Marginalized Histories in Bahamian Art, 1950 to 1960s, at the Manton Research Center, is it? And a seminar. How were they received?
Yeah, so that was a special moment. You know, this was my first public lecture as an emerging art historian. So it was heavy for me.
Congrats.
It was a special moment. Let's put it that way. Thank you so much. I must say that the responsibility of that kind of that label, that title, it made me realize that this thing isn't just research. This is history. When you think about this moment, what I'm sharing, this is not just, you know, everybody has access to a article that was produced and it's in the public domain and we're now just kind of reviewing, synthesizing, analyzing. No, I'm finding some information that for the most part has never been really seen in the public domain or really been viewed in that way. So for instance, when we look at Donald Russell, who established his academy in the early 50s after returning from the Art Students League in New York, although I don't have a photograph of how he looks and only one reference to a painting of his that is included in the Bahamian Art 1492 textbook that's like about almost 30 years old, I have and was able to get from the Art Students League a record of his student enrollment. And so you could see the art classes he took. You can see how he took a break from the institution so that he could be with his family in a time of kind of grief. And it's just so amazing to be able to see that, because even though we don't have a photograph, we know that he existed, because it's a certain thing, I think, that if you don't have information about someone, they become like this myth. And I think the idea of these figures as myths is why they haven't really been kind of unearthed, you know, in the past. And the lecture, although within a space that for the most part, this is very new to them, this scholarship, you know, the Caribbean Arts and its Diasporas Fellowship is a new fellowship that was just established last year. So coming into this space and giving this kind of talk and speaking about this type of work is very new for this audience. And so although I was giving them the lecture, it was really the recording of that lecture is for those people back home. I said in the lecture, I said, this work is not for me. This is for my people. This is for those people who love their country, who want to know more about who they are and where their people have come from. And so in many ways, the research has been suppressed for over 70 years, but I think the Q&A from that lecture made me realize, although the audience may not know about what Bahamian art is prior to that lecture, I think within the Q&A, because there are the types of questions that were coming up, it made it very, very evident that what I was sharing was important work. And that for me is what resonates. And then when we go back to the seminar, which was the following day, the feedback from that seminar, because the seminar is framed around, it's a little bit more intimate. You're dealing with just the scholars that are part of the visiting fellowship program, then some of the grad students with interests that align with my research, and then one or two independent scholars. So a very intimate setting, and the type of feedback, it was exceptional, because here you have a lot of voices coming to the fore and bringing their own sensibilities, their own types of their ways of thinking. And so you had these ideas of how do you position the arts in a way that nationalism starts to like debunk the framing of the Bahamas as this tropical paradise? Because for many years, even now, that's how we're looked at, as a paradise. And yes, tourism is our major industry, we get that, but we are still kind of almost marginalized to only that, right? And so here we have the suggestion of what can be done to give the Bahamas more visibility outside of that framing. And then talking about like embracing oral history, which I knew was going to be paramount to this work. And this is something that has been done extensively by Dr. Tracy Thompson in her establishment of the From That Times Oral History Institute. And so I foresee some collaboration there, because I think in order to get this work done, it being bigger than me, I have to work with like-minded people. I can't be territorial. I can't take this on as my own. This belongs to us. So I see that happening and I see that working. And then we talked about decolonizing the archival kind of practice and what that means in breaking away from this ideal of the institution, which I imagine won't be something that's the theory of it won't be highly embraced, because, you know, what do you mean community archive? You know, this got to be at the National Archives. This has to be at the University of the Bahamas. And so conversations like that, you know, returning back home are what I expect to have, but I embrace every voice that wants to be a part of this new movement, this new energy towards what I call memory repatriation.
Mm-hmm. Keisha Oliver, our conversation has been riveting. I've certainly been captivated and intrigued, and I'm hoping that our listeners have as well. If anyone has an interest in partnering with you or supporting the work that you're doing, how can they reach out to you or connect with you as we wrap up?
So I am very happy to embrace all voices, because like I said, this is a community effort. And although I have started this kind of resurgence of this work, I think it's important for people to feel that they can reach out, feel that they can collaborate and work together. And I am open to that. So I have created an email dedicated to this project until I have secured a domain. And it is Bahamas Arts Archive @gmail.com. So they can email me there. I also have started to secure certain social media spaces within Instagram and Facebook and so forth. There is a domain for the tentative archive using the digital repository Omeka. That's a platform that's used as an industry standard that's used. And so that's secure, but now I'm in the process of collating, getting permissions, all of that. And that takes time. If you want to treat this project and give it the due diligence, you have to massage that reality in a way that is professional. And so if I can't be contacted on BahamasArtsArchive@gmail.com, I am more than happy to continue the conversation at my UB email, keisha.oliver@ub.edu.bs. And I'm excited. I think the possibilities of this, particularly given the changes in our governance as a people within, you know, the past couple of weeks, and the energy these new the new kind of representatives of our different ministries and different kind of spaces are doing. This is a time for exciting and new progressive thought, and I'm more than happy to be a part of that conversation.
Well, we are more than happy to have you share your experience and your research on University Drive, our road to progress. And so thank you so much for joining us for this episode. We wish you all the best. We know that you will do extremely well and this project will grow even larger and have a very substantive footprint. That wraps up our show here on University Drive. Remember to stay connected with University of the Bahamas. Visit us at www.ub.edu.bs and also follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and we're also on TikTok, University of the Bahamas. Thank you so much for listening. That brings us to the end. Goodbye.
University Drive is a production of the Office of University Relations and the Communications and Creative Arts Academic Unit at University of the Bahamas. All rights reserved.